I'd like to begin by saying that Russia does not want peace, but she wants victory. And there's a big difference. The Russians are famous for having peace conferences. They talk about peace. I've had dialogue with communists in many parts of the world, and they talk about peace. In fact, you'll even hear them quoting, the lion and the lamb shall lay down together. And you say, wow, they've been reading Isaiah. No, they haven't. They've been reading Karl Marx. Because when they talk about the lion and the lamb laying down together, in their minds, the lamb is inside the lion. That's their concept of peace. Their definition of peace, and we'll get to this a little later on when we talk about definitions of words, their definition of peace is the total cessation of all opposing points of view. There is peace today in East Germany. There is peace today in Romania and Bulgaria and Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland. My wife and I have just been through most of those countries within the last 12 months. And there's peace in those countries. But it's not the kind of peace I would want to live under, because it's a total cessation of any opposing point of view. You cannot have another point of view. The point of view, the totalitarian, ruthless point of view of the atheists is imposed upon you. That's their concept of peace. So we've already seen how they have been spreading their influence around the world. I want us to look today at the control points, because I am convinced that Moscow wants control more than confrontation. She's becoming bolder. She will confront if necessary. But more than anything else, she wants control. And so she is working very hard to gain control. That was the name of the game in Southeast Asia. They wanted control there. Not necessarily of the land that would be the rice paddies to feed the hungry hordes of Asia. It wasn't so much to be able to have advantage of the hydroelectric power from the Mekong Delta. The main purpose of Vietnam was to control the passageway through the Malaya Straits into the Indian Ocean. We saw last week how that during the Watergate period of 18 months, when in the United States we were hearing nothing but Watergate, the Russians were systematically taking over every port, every major port in the Indian Ocean, from Chittagong around the subcontinent to Berbera on the Somali coast. They had objectives. Last year witnessed the giveaway of the American Canal in Panama. That was the American Canal. We paid for it at least four times. It's like any other purchase. If you buy a house, if you buy property, it's yours by deed. We had paid for the canal four times. There are some who estimate we'd paid for it six times. I think you have to stretch it a little bit to include six times. But we specifically paid four different entities for the canal. I don't have time to go into just now, but we paid Panama, we paid the squatters that moved in, we paid off the French for the rusty old equipment that they left behind, and we paid $25 million to Colombia a few years later, probably as conscience money. But be that as it may, we paid four times for the Panama Canal. And then our legislators have given it away to a leftist, Marxist government in Panama. I was in Panama last month and have seen how they've taken down the American flag and they've raised their Panamanian flag, and there's great euphoria there at the moment, but it will soon be dispelled when the reality of a Marxist dictatorship comes in. And when you look at Panama and link it with the axis that it already has established even before we gave them the canal, there is this axis between Panama and Havana, you see that it is effectively split in half the hemispheres, dividing North and South America from each other, cutting us in half. We'll get back to that choke point in just a moment, but I want us to think for a moment about the Suez Canal, another passageway. I want us to think about the Cape Sea Route around South Africa. These are strategically important areas. And when they can gain control of those passage areas, then they can interdict the free movement of supplies and personnel from one place to another. They wanted to control the southern entrance to the Suez, to the Red Sea, which of course leads to the Suez Canal, and would close this waterway here, at least control it effectively. Now, to get into there, they went in through the back door. After the Second World War, the British missed a tremendous opportunity to reestablish the various different people according to national and ethnic and cultural groups by simply redefining some of these borders along here. They could have then included the people of traditional heritage and nationality and of language. Instead, they stuck to the old borders, and as a result, the Somalis kept saying, we are going to unite our people, and they wanted to unite their people in the Ogaden. Well, Ethiopia didn't want them to do that because that was still their territory. So as a result, there was a war there, or a pending war, and the Somalis were making all the appropriate noises as far as war was concerned. So Russia comes in on the scene and says to the Somalis, we'll give you all the arms and ammunition you need, provided you allow us to build a base here in Berbera. They said, fine, that's wonderful. So the Russians supplied the Somalis with arms and ammunition. The Russians built their base here in Berbera at about approximately this point. And the Somalis did what they'd been talking about and saying they were going to do. They launched an aggressive war to free or liberate their people and to unite their people over here in the Ogaden. Now, Ethiopia began to fight against them to protect what was regarded as their sovereign territory. So you can see there's the problem existing there. Ethiopia had a right to defend their sovereign territory because Britain had missed the opportunity to reunite these people and slightly redraw the borders there after the Second World War. But the Somalis did what they'd been saying they were going to do with Russian arms and ammunition. Now then, the Ethiopians were outgunned and about to lose. So the Ethiopians applied for weaponry, and the Russians said, oh, we'll give you all the weaponry you want. And so the Russians supplied the Ethiopians, and they even said, we'll send in advisors. So they sent in Cuban, of all people, advisors into Ethiopia, and Ethiopia was very quickly taken over by the communists, and now Ethiopia, which has a tradition of Christianity, going right back to the Ethiopian eunuch who was converted by the evangelist Philip there in the deserts near Samaria, and went back. He was on an official state visit there and went back to Ethiopia and founded the Christian church, and there's been a history of Christianity for 1900 years in Ethiopia. Ethiopia now is a Marxist state with Cubans there holding the power and Russians in control. And, of course, the Somalis were furious when the Russians began to give arms to Ethiopia. And so the Somalis kicked the Russians out of Berbera, the coastal port here, but it didn't matter because Russia had obtained her objective by getting these straits right here. Of course, when Britain pulled back from everything east of Aden, this is the important port of Aden here, and my wife and I were living in England during the decline of the British Empire, and as Britain went down, as they began to pull back and compromise and appease, they pulled back and everything east of Aden, and here is this port city that now the Russians have rushed in to fill the vacuum. And so this whole of South Yemen is now a communist country. And this is one of the most principal ports here, the port of Aden, which controls the southern entrance to the Red Sea. So it's important to understand how they want to control these passageways, these points. Recently, my wife and I stood on Table Mountain, and we could look to see where the Atlantic and the Indian Oceans join. You can see it from Table Mountain that towers above Cape Town here on the tip of the continent. And as I looked out to sea, I counted 22 super tankers. They're too large to go through the Suez Canal. They have to take the Cape Sea route. I counted 22 of them at any one given time, coming around the Cape, bound for America with oil. The projection is that all things being equal and barring a war and so forth, that by the year 1985, there will be one super tanker every 30 miles. They will follow each other every 30 miles. I don't know if you can imagine what that means. A super tanker every 30 miles. When you translate that into the expressway language, it's like rush hour traffic. Maritimely speaking, that's like the rush hour traffic at 5 o'clock with everybody trying to get home. Can you imagine what happens if some guy has a blowout and slams on his brakes? The guy behind him piles into him. Suddenly, everything grinds to a halt and all the traffic on the freeway comes to a halt. You've experienced it. That's what would happen with the sinking virtually of one super tanker on the Cape Sea route. So you see how vulnerable we are to the trade routes and the supply of oil around the Cape. So it's very, very important to the Russians that they control southern Africa. By that I mean Rhodesia, South Africa. Those are the principal countries because not only of the strategic value here as far as the Cape Sea routes, but also because of the vast mineral wealth. We'll get to that in just a moment. Carrying on now, talking about the sea lanes and the choke points, here is another choke point here in this area. Have you been counting how many of these islands have had a coup within the last 2 years and now have Marxist governments in them? We think of Cuba as being, of course, a Marxist country, a communist country in the Caribbean. Now Cuba is expanding her revolution to many of these islands that dot throughout the Caribbean. And when you look at this, you'll see and look at the map how these islands just come in a chain up through here. And remember that 75% of all the oil that is imported into the United States comes through the Caribbean to the Gulf oil refineries, Gulfport oil refineries along our Gulf Coast. 75% of all our imported oil. So can you imagine what would happen if they choke off the Caribbean here? The only entrance from the Pacific is through the Panama Canal, which now they have successfully taken. And if they are able to, by various coups and overthrows of government, form a chain reaction through these Antilles here, through the islands of the West Indies, they will be able to choke off this Caribbean basin. And, of course, right in the very middle of the Caribbean basin is Cuba, the hub of the Marxist wheel there in the Caribbean. When my wife and I landed last year in Buenos Aires in Argentina, we were astounded to find it's about a 2 hour drive from the airport into downtown, and all the way in we were astounded to see how that Argentina has mobilized for war. Can you imagine that? Have you heard of Argentina going to war? Do you know who she's going to war with? There is a war pending between Argentina and Chile. We're not even hearing about it here in North America. The only way I can keep abreast of this is to keep plugged into various different news gathering sources from overseas, and at night we pull up our aerial and listen to the BBC or Radio Hilversum or some of the overseas broadcasts in order to get some of the news from overseas. But there is a war pending between these two, and the dispute is over the Beagle Channel through here as to who controls this important passageway around Cape Horn. So here again you have the struggle between the communist forces. China is backing Chile and Russia is backing Argentina. Argentina up to now has refused Chinese aid, Russian aid, and Chile has turned virtually a cold shoulder to the Chinese aid. But how long can they hold out when these two countries are being egged on to have war with each other? They're going to have some material and some supply from somewhere. So that the Russians could gain control, or the communists could gain control, of this important passageway around here. You will remember that Chile was the only country in the world ever to elect a communist government. Why Chile? Why did they concentrate on Chile? Because of the trade routes around the Cape. Because if you'll notice the map, Chile controls Tierra del Fuego and the trade routes around Cape Horn. So if they control Chile, it gives them control of the important shipping lanes around the Cape. Now, we move to Peru, to look at Peru. Peru is threatening to attack Chile because they want to take back the northernmost city of Chile called Arica. Arica was taken from Peru by Chile about 100 years ago in a war. And so the communist in Peru, I was just in Lima, Peru last month, and the communist here in Peru are agitating to stir up strife, to have a war between Peru and Chile in order to take back the northernmost city of Arica. And Bolivia, now landlocked, but remembering that once upon a time they did have a short corridor to the sea, says, well, hey, Peru, we will join with you and also with Argentina to whack off a little bit more of the string bean of Chile so that we can have a waterway to the Pacific. We can have a sea opening there. What I'm trying to say is that the communists are doing all that they can to exploit and to agitate and to create strife and hatred and war among people. Because as long as they can have war, as long as they can have that kind of strife, then there will be vacuums created. And of course the Soviets are masters at rushing in to fill whatever vacuum is created. Now we've talked about the sea lanes and how important they are and how it's important to the Russians to be able to control the sea lanes. Let's talk for a moment about why they want to control the sea lanes. Do they just want to put their boats out there so they can roam around at random? No. If they can, through control of natural resources, bring the Western industrial nations to their knees in total financial and industrial collapse, they will have won, almost hands down. And this is their objective. I personally do not believe that they want a military confrontation at this time. That is not to rule it out. I believe there will be a war in the Middle East. I believe it will be soon. Whether or not it will be over a widespread area will remain, of course, to be seen. As to how much we're willing to escalate it or they are willing to escalate it, how much we're willing to up the bid. The point is, if they can deprive the Western industrial nations of the raw materials that are so necessary for everybody's economy, for the economy, the industrialized economy of the Western nations, and also for the livelihood of the people in whose lands these raw materials exist in great abundance. Now, this is really, this southern area of Africa is really the pocketbook. And the communist thieves want to reach into the pocketbook to get their hands on the control of the vital mineral wealth here in southern Africa. 54 of the world's minerals exist in southern Africa in large, I mean by that 50 to 60% of all the known resources in the world exist here in enormous proportions. And there are about 11 minerals that are found here exclusively. Take, for instance, chrome, found only in Rhodesia and in some isolated parts of the Soviet Union. The Soviet chrome is inferior to the Rhodesian chrome. And when we ganged up and put sanctions on Little Rhodesia, saying that Rhodesia was a threat to world peace, that is the most preposterous statement I have ever heard. My wife and I have traveled extensively all over Rhodesia. And do you think it posed any kind of a threat, sweetheart? Impossible. The threat to Rhodesia is posed by the communists, who want to take over and gain control of those raw materials. But we ganged up with the rest of the world and imposed sanctions on Rhodesia and would not buy chrome from them. But the Russians bought chrome, even during this period of sanction, the Russians bought chrome via Mozambique and via Zambia from Rhodesia. And then the Russians sent us, we bought chrome then from the Russians, they sent us their inferior chrome and charged us more for it than we'd been paying for the best quality chrome from Rhodesia prior to sanctions. It draws me to the conclusion that sometimes, with regard to our foreign policy, I think we ought to exchange our national emblem from the eagle to the cuckoo bird. I think that would make a little bit more sense as far as our foreign policy is concerned. But it's the natural resources, the mineral wealth of southern Africa that is really the objective of the Marxist. I thought as I stood on top of Table Mountain and looked southward to the sea, and as I was seeing and watching those super tankers coming around the Cape, I thought, well, they could control all of this if they controlled South Africa. And then it suddenly hit me. 75% of all the gold in the world is in South Africa. Coupled with the known gold reserves and the vastness of the Soviet Union would give them, the Soviet Union, 96% of all the gold in the world. Can you imagine what would happen? That would mean that overnight the economic seesaw would tilt and the already weakened American dollar would become the soft currency and the Russian ruble would become the hard currency. And we wouldn't even be able to buy oil, much less get it around the Cape. Now that is the geopolitical aspect of the picture. As a missionary, I am concerned with the missionary aspect, with the Christian aspect of this particular problem that we're discussing today. It has been estimated that 87% of all the missionary work in the world is financed by American Christians. So what would happen to 87% of all the missionary work that goes on the face of planet Earth if our dollar was totally worthless? It would dry up unless our missionaries overseas could quickly learn how to be tent makers. 87% of missionary work overseas would dry up if America's currency ultimately failed. Now, when you begin to see it in that context, then you can begin to understand that this thing is bigger than we ever imagined. It's bigger than the communists. It's bigger than the Illuminati. It's bigger than the Trilateral Commission. It's bigger than the Council for Foreign Relations. It's bigger than all of those things. Behind it is Satan himself. And we understand that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And part of this class will be to show you some of the areas in which Satan is gaining inroads and to give you and put into your hands tools whereby you as a Christian can have a tool to work with. That's the importance of this seminar. That's the importance of this class, to give you, first of all, to give you an understanding of the problem, and then to give you tools to know how to go about to solve the problem. So as we look at the map and see how much of the map is red, we could very easily become discouraged. We could become despondent. We could begin to say, wow, what hope is there? We've lost. We might as well give up. In fact, I hear sometimes radio preachers, and I have to be careful here because I have a daily radio program myself on a growing number of stations across the country, and I have to be very careful when I talk about my fellow broadcasters, but sometimes when I hear a broadcaster talking about communism, when he's talking about it, I get the idea. Now, he doesn't say this, but I get the idea from some of them. When I hear them talk about communism and the expanse and spread of communism, I get the idea that God could handle the Amalekites and the Jebusites and the Hittites and the Syrians and the Babylonians and all those people, but now that he's met the communist, he's met his match. Now, of course, only that statement only has to be stated to be dismissed as incredible. He that is in you than he that is in the world. And our verse that we're learning, and I hope will be a key verse in this seminar, will be that God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. That's the spirit that God has given to us. And so we're not fearful when we look at these things. I was just reading again this morning, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and coupled with that, Daniel chapter 11 and 12. Those are companion areas of the Scripture, and it is exciting. It's thrilling, again, to see how God is shaping up, how he's putting hooks into Gog and Magog's jaw to draw them into all this. So that why? So that we can have a great victory, or so that we can keep our oil supplies, or so that we can have access to raw materials? No. So that his name can be glorified, and all the earth will know that he is God. Now that gets exciting. I'll tell you, if you cut my shoestrings, I'd take off, you know. I get so excited when I think of what God is doing in this particular age. Now to bring it to a close on a positive note, I want you to just, we'll just take one country and just, this is a little bit of speculation, but this is how God could do it. This is only one way that God could do it, and His ways are past finding out. God is extravagant in His originality. There are no two snowflakes exactly alike. There are no two blades of grass exactly alike. And God just has a myriad of ways in which He can do it. And I can think of one way, and I'm going to share it with you just now. Take China, for instance. We talked last week about the fact that one out of every four people living on the face of the earth is Chinese. 1 billion people living in China. Let's imagine for a moment that there would be no more Chinese babies born. Now that, of course, is impossible from the very beginning, but just imagine that something happened and no more Chinese babies were born. And let's imagine that through the preaching of the gospel, you had Pentecost every single day with 3,000 people coming to know Jesus Christ every day. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Do you know how long it would take to convert China? You can work it out on your little hand computer like I did, your little pocket calculator. It would take 760 years to convert China. Isn't that incredible? That's if no more Chinese babies are born, if 3,000 people were converted every day, it would take 760 years to convert the present population of China. When Hudson Taylor went out to China to found the China Inland Mission, when he went out as a missionary, he was confronted initially with three basic problems. First of all, there was the language barrier. Someone living in the north of China could not understand someone living in the south of China. Secondly, there was no transportation, no roads. You just had to, get to a place the best way you could, and then you were stuck there. There was no sort of transportation or road system to be able to link the country together. Thirdly, you had the problem, a cultural problem, of introducing an Occidental Jesus to an Oriental mind. You had to hack your way through 3,500 years of Chinese culture and history in order to present Jesus. That was Hudson Taylor's problem. Great problem. Formidable problem. Now, it's interesting that when the communists moved into China under the leadership of Mao Zedong in the late 40s and early 50s and took over, they faced exactly the same problem. They faced the language problem. They faced the transportation problem. They faced the cultural problem. So they set about to solve those problems. They reduced the Chinese language from some 22,000 characters to something like 2,000 characters and made it a universal Chinese language. It's called the New Chinese Language. Everybody speaks that particular language. One language now in China. They set about to build roads to link China, all the parts of China together. Now, they're not interstate highways. Some of them aren't even paved, but they are roads, and you can get buses and trucks over them, and that's important. So they have roads. You remember during the mid-60s and the latter part of the 60s, the Cultural Revolution, the Red Guards moving in? They were told anything that's old is bad, destroy it. So they went into temples, libraries, everything, and destroyed them. Within 7 years, they had pillaged and burned and wiped out and destroyed some 3,000 years of Chinese history, creating a fantastic cultural vacuum in China. Now I want you to just imagine with me, when you introduce the Holy Spirit into this particular area, and the gospel, which is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, introduce this element now into a context where there's one language, where there are many roads, and where there's a cultural vacuum, and what do you think is going to happen? I believe that we are on the threshold of the greatest revival that the world has ever seen for coming up on the books for China. So we want to end on a positive note. Greater is He that is in you than he that is in the world. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind.